aspects of the integrity of it. So you don't do that because you're whole. But McLuhan says that modern man's integrity, his sense of his own wholeness, has been destroyed by the unnoticed assumptions of our culture. Environments, McLuhan says, are invisible. And yet these invisible environments, they're not just the wrappings of life, they are processes which affect us in the most basic way that we perceive the world and other people and ourselves. We are conditioned by these invisible environments in the way in which we fundamentally conceive things. And as we begin, so shall we go. Everything then follows from these unnoticed assumptions, including our fragmentation. And as a result of this fragmentation, says McLuhan, modern man is tormented by anxiety. He is isolated from his fellow man. He doesn't really know how to get in touch with other people. And each man is an island. And he's an alien in the world, too. He finds the world a strange place. At times, man overcomes his anxiety and sense of alienation from the world by trying to master and dominate it. And he sees everything in the world as a means to an end, something that he should do something with. If he can't do anything with it, he retreats from it. I don't know, this is probably silly and I'm just a hopeless romantic, but I do not like blasting interstate highways through mountains. Somehow I feel when there's a mountain there, the road must respect the mountain and wind its way up by switchbacks across the mountain. I've come many times now over round Butte, across the Continental Divide, just the other side of Butte, some of you have to, I'm sure. And there used to be nice roads that wound up over the pass and kind of twisted and turned your way up there. And now, you had the feeling you got into the mountain, the mountain surrounded you, and you became one with the mountain. But not now. Now we climb by a bulldozer on top of the mountain and we rule the mountain. And this is the only way we can treat the world. If the world can't be mastered by us, if we can't turn it into a means for our ends, then we feel anxious and threatened by the world. But all of this McLuhan attributes to the alphabet and the printing press. Repeat something I said yesterday, is Dwight McDonald says, that's what I call a thesis. Compared to that, Toynbee is cautious and conservative, and Spengler is positive and pedantic. But the alphabet and the printing press are media, or tools, or techniques, or as McLuhan likes to call them, extensions of man. And McLuhan says, every extension of man warps his perceptions. Take a silly example. The invention of the hammer, which is an extension of the arm, will warp man's perception. Now, because it's been invented along with a lot of other things and isn't that important, we don't get warped too much. But if the hammer had been more important, if everything were hammered, this would extend our right arm so tremendously that we would soon lose the capacity for real touch and feeling in the left hand. That's the kind of thing the clue is after. That the extension of man in media so directs his attention to the extended media that he is incapable after a while of thinking and conceiving in terms not related to the extension of that particular medium. Well, what the alphabet and print technology, the development of the printing press and the multiplication, proliferation of books, what these did was extend man's capacity to discern logical, lineal relationships at the price of a squelched capacity to discern field relationships. Everything now is seen in terms of sequences. One thing after another, cause and effect. Every effect has a cause, every cause has an effect. Causation is always from former to later, and it's sort of in a direct line. But there's another way of viewing the universe, and of course it's the way McLuhan tries to write his books, that there is no logical sequence or neat lineal progression, but everything sort of affects everything else, McLuhan says. I write in a mosaic pattern. These the alphabet print technology taught man to view everything, and this comes now very close to the heart of matter, under the image of mechanism. This is the way we've been conditioned. So that we seek to understand everything, and we find it perfectly natural. Well, of course, why not? How else? Under the image of mechanism. So that if you tell a modern man now that something is not fundamentally like a machine, he scratches his head. He says, well, everything is basically like a machine. That's how you understand things. If you want to know how, well, let me take something now where there's a, I'm not talking about the frontline scientists, but I'm talking about the educated, intelligent man on the street. Take research into DNA. How is this to be understood? The man on the street sees the scientist, he has an image of the scientist as getting down into the secret of the DNA molecule, always by employing the image of the machine. Eventually, when we unlock the secret of DNA, we will understand it as a complicated machine. Even man himself, consequently, makes no sense to himself when he thinks about himself, except when he is thought of basically as a machine. We are all complicated machines, the machine of the human body. The well-oiled cement. You see how marvelous is our body, what a marvelous machine God has created here. Organisms make sense to man today only insofar as he can reduce them mentally to machines. Well, now, there are two avenues of assault on McLuhan here, if you want to attack him. One is to say it can't be so, that we don't think this way, we haven't been fragmented, our integrity has not been destroyed. Another line of attack, and you can use both of them, is to say, well, it is so, but it isn't for the reasons he says. Now, I'm personally convinced, deeply convinced, that it is so. That the situation of modern man is basically as McLuhan describes it. But I'm not fully persuaded by McLuhan's argument that print is the villain. And as I said, I'll warn you, this may be, McLuhan would say it is, because I am so much the captive of print. I'm so wed to print. McLuhan, even in an interview recently with Gerald Stearns in Encounter magazine, suggests that he too is wed to print. He says, personally, I have a private distaste for much of what is happening through television and electric technology, because I too am very fond of print, which you would sort of expect from a man who has his PhD in Renaissance literature. The trouble is, when I get very unhappy with McLuhan's assigning so much importance, historical importance, to the printing press, that I have no alternative hypothesis of comparable scope. And so I just can't attack McLuhan like I would love to. But it seems to me that this much, at least, of McLuhan's thesis can be very amply documented, and has been documented in a number of books, that Western thought characteristically conceives everything as matter. And matter is understood basically in Cartesian-Newtonian terms. The Cartesian-Newtonian model is the machine. This is not so much the conclusion of an argument as it is the presupposition of all argument in our culture. If you handle something not as machine, but along the lines of some other model, you will always be saying, well, that's just an unfortunate necessity. Eventually, when knowledge progresses far enough, then we will be able to handle this as machine. For example, political scientists may today they don't all use the image of the machine, but that is simply because political science does not get advanced far enough. When political science finally arrives and becomes truly scientific, then it will conceive all in terms of the image of the machine. Because everything finally is machine. In the study of man, today, the most vivid elaboration and extension of this presupposition is in the writings of B.F. Skinner, the experimental psychologist at Harvard University. B.F. Skinner recently was given a big feature in the New York Times, which some of you may have seen. Of course, he's constantly quoted and is I think without doubt, the single most influential psychologist in the United States, David Curie here. I think that's pretty safe. That doesn't mean that the majority of psychologists are in his camp, but he does have camp followers. There are people for whom he is the Messiah. But I think that no psychologist enjoys more influence today than B.F. Skinner. And Skinner, as I said, has most vividly elaborated and extended this presupposition that man himself is basically machine. No one has done it better than Skinner, more my way of thinking, in a more frightening way. You don't have to read Skinner's technical works in order to understand what he's doing. He's set down his basic scheme of thought in a little novel, a very bad novel. He's not really a novelist. His characters don't leap alive from the page. You get the impression they're machines. But then the novel is Walden, too. I think I saw a copy from the bookstore. It's not bad. A lot of students read it today. In fact, when the book was first published right after World War II, it didn't sell many copies. And gradually it caught on. And Skinner says this is because people are beginning to see the truth of what I was arguing for back there in the 1940s. Well, I've been on a couple of campuses where I've seen hundreds and hundreds of copies of that book purchased by students because they were required to buy it for courses. And what happened to it in the course is that it was pilloried. So I have a hunch Skinner is wrong about the reason. He thinks he's winning the day. It's widely used in political science courses as an examination of anti-democratic thought. And interestingly, Skinner predicts in the book that that's what will happen to it through the mouth of one of his characters. The New York Times article on Skinner recently suggested that it didn't say it flatly, but it strongly left the impression that eventually Skinner's view of man and how man must be studied will triumph. My question is, must it triumph? What's the evidence? McLuhan now would say it will not triumph. It's dead. Skinner's worldview is dead. It should have been dead a long time ago because it was totally inadequate to begin with. But it will certainly die now because man is being delivered from the basic presuppositions of Skinner, the basic presuppositions that make Skinner seem to make sense at all. He's being delivered by television or electric technology. That, I'm afraid, I can't buy. I just do not see electric technology as the great savior. And maybe we can get into this sometime, but I'm afraid I feel that electric technology really is extending some of the same overextended senses that were extended by print. I just see television as having a totally different impact. Last week, I spent a little time talking, quite a bit of time, in fact, talking to some teenagers who were up here, one of the weekly groups, trying to find out whether the things that McLuhan says about teenagers' perceptions of the world, because see, they've been conditioned by television, not by print, see if these things were true. And I don't think they are true. I'm persuaded they are not true. That television has simply made the younger generation more evil than we ourselves. That's horrible. That the things that are wrong with us because we read too many books, are even more wrong with our sons and daughters because they haven't read enough books. Well, never mind that. That's unfair. I apologize to all teenagers. I love teenagers because they're only teenagers for a few years. I personally look somewhere else for salvation. In human terms now, it's to a recovery of rationality in the classic sense of that word, or what I yesterday called man's spiritual capacity, or what I think Jerry meant when he talked about imagination, a capacity of self-transcendence. It seems to me that man is going to have to, the time is growing late, man is going to have to notice and respect this capacity in himself. And why doesn't he do so any longer? That's the question. Well, I wanted to suggest today that one of the important reasons why man does not do so, why man does not respect his own spiritual capacity, his power to transcend himself, why man instead tends to view himself as, the way I put it crudely yesterday, as finally just like a rock, only a bit more complicated. A good part of the reason, I think, lies in the misunderstanding of science in our time. That we have sort of surrendered ourselves the way some religious people surrender to faith. We have surrendered to science, which wouldn't be so bad at all if the science to which we were surrendering were science as she actually is. But what we have surrendered to is a misunderstanding, a perversion, and a distortion of science. The British scientist, philosopher, who's now living in the United States, I think, novelist and poet, Jacob Bronowski, has written a little book called Science and Human Values. Right? We cannot shirk the historic question, what is truth? Of course, we are shirking that all over the place today. That somebody asks, what is truth? And we all, like Pontius Pilate, hurry away without waiting for an answer. We're not interested in what is truth. We're interested in what works. On the contrary, Bronowski goes on, the civilization we take pride in took a new strength on the day that question was asked. It took its greatest strength from men in whom truth to fact became a passion. And he mentions this in a chapter of his book called The Habit of Truth, where I think he's employing the metaphor of a monk who puts on this habit and is then dedicated to truth wherever it leads. Nothing, then, no phenomenon is foreign to him. Nothing will be excluded. He takes all into account because his passion, his commitment is to truth. Now these men were predominantly the men of science, the men whom Bronowski says developed his passion for truth. Science originated around the time of the Renaissance in this new passion for truth, this determination to ask what is truth. Unfortunately, at the base of our culture stand not only the accomplishments of science and this creed of science, but also its misunderstanding, the widespread misunderstanding of the nature of science itself. I think it's very commonly believed among us that science is some kind of big dictionary of facts. Science is an enormous cookbook, and that its achievements proceeded from the meticulous plodding, heaping up of one observation upon another. That the laws or theories or hypotheses of science are generalizations that have just sort of emerged spontaneously from this patient process of accumulating bits and pieces. Now, there are many things that are wrong with this picture. In the first place, it incorrectly assumes that facts speak for themselves, and that they don't have to be arranged and interpreted before they can say anything at all. But of course they do. Facts do not speak for themselves. There is an originative element in every act of perception. This is quite familiar to anybody who reflects upon it. You see what you expect to see. As Bronowski puts it, scientists, is a very vivid phrase, it's good, we need this guy. Scientists, he says, do not discover order, they create. That's a good counter, at least, to the mistaken emphasis of our time. This misunderstanding, this notion that all science is just proceeded from men in white coats, machines in white coats, piling up fact after fact, and then hypotheses finally emerge. This ignores the element of novelty in every theoretical construction by failing to see that in a deep sense, order has to be not just discovered, but even created, imposed upon what we observe. This view totally overlooks the faith in the order of nature, which has made possible the growth of science. There is a faith at the bottom of science, a faith that the universe is orderly, that things do not hop about in a random fashion, but that God is faithful, and he won't cheat us, that he behaves uniformly throughout the universe. In short, the popular view of science consistently overlooks the creative role of human reason in the building up of that very monumental and impressive structure that we call modern science. But the creative role of human reason is ignored because we prefer, in a sense, the cookbook view of science. It makes us more comfortable in some sense, and it profoundly colors our image of man. Science is supposed to be adherence to a mechanical procedure. That's so often seen as, unfortunately, we teach this to kids in high school sometimes. We did when I was in high school. What is the scientific method? It is observation, induction, deduction, experiment, observation, induction. So that if you just get locked into the system, out comes great science, antibiotics, drugs, and all the works. Truth emerges from this process in the same way that a cake emerges for every housewife who follows the directions on the cake mix box. And scientists have sometimes encouraged this misunderstanding by labeling their procedures empirical and then setting them in opposition to such inferior modes of knowing as rationalism. Now, that's ridiculous. You cannot contrast empiricism with rationalism because you cannot experience without thinking. They go together. It may be possible to experience without thinking. I suppose if you got on a drug like LSD, that may be the kind of thing that's happening, that you're experiencing without thinking. But the result is buzzing confusion, not science. It's a potpourri of undisciplined impressions. It's not knowledge. Because science, I want to define science as a disciplined and creative activity of human reason. By golly, that's what she is. And science is no less than that, a disciplined and creative activity of human reason. Which means that science cannot repudiate the credentials of reason without undermining its own authority, and of course thereby negating its own demonstration. Despite this fact, there are some thinkers who, as W. McNeil Dixon put it in his book on the human situation, who, having done their best to cut off the branch upon which they are sitting, continue with superb confidence to sit upon it. Why? Why does this happen? Why are so many people, including some of the finest intellects of our time, determined to minimize or even deny the role of reason and of disciplined creativity in scientific activity? I think there's a profound paradox. And of course, here's where McLuhan comes in. He says, they do this because of certain presuppositions which have been bred into them by print technology and so on. But I don't want to go that far. I want to look at just the things that I think we can observe and check for ourselves that either make sense or don't make sense, and maybe won't make sense to you. But I think this is rooted, first of all, in a very simple and plausible ideal. Why have people understood science as a mechanical activity? And first of all, there's an ideal at work here. We know that subjectivity is a source of distortion and error, don't we? Never trust the manager of the home team to call the balls and strikes. His vision is just as good as the umpire's, maybe better, but we suspect that he may be a little, the distortion and error may be introduced by his subjectivity. So you can't just assume the accuracy of reports. When somebody says, my son comes home and says, what happened? And comes in crying, Eric hit me. Why, what did you do to Eric? I just tapped him. I can't assume the accuracy of that report, even when he's completely honest in his intention. Which he usually is. So science has been compelled by its passion for truth toward an ideal of objective knowledge, of knowledge free from the distortions of subjectivity. Now, all human knowledge is obviously personal in some sense. At least I don't see how you can conclude anything else. There can be no knowledge, it seems to me, without a knower. And knowing is by definition subjective. How can you get around this? You want to get some objective knowledge, but all knowledge seems to be subjective. Science has tried to resolve this problem by making its the criterion of knowledge the repeatable experiment. So subjective knowledge becomes objective when it is available to anyone on precisely similar terms. Sure. What I report, I observe, and so that's subjective knowledge, and it may be distorted and partial, and you can't trust it. But a piece of subjective knowledge becomes what we call an objective fact. When a particular procedure yields the same results for everyone who employs the procedure. And in this way, private insight becomes public truth. So, for example, I announce the far side of the moon is made of green cheese. And people say, how do you know? And I say, I observed it. Well, and then what do they ask me to do? They say, tell us what procedure you employ so that we can employ that procedure and get the same results that you got. And if that happens, then it becomes an objective fact. Which, of course, it's still subjective and still, it may be wrong, you know, but it still, it passes into the realm of objective fact. Now, this, I think in this way, we took a first and a very large step toward identifying scientific truth with the results of mechanical procedure. Now, one step remained to complete the process. Now you've got to submit the procedures themselves to rule. So you can't just have anybody running around inventing his own procedure. They must become canons of procedure, with a very minimum of room for personal improvisation or virtuosic embellishment. And then, as Michael Polanyi puts it, it seems almost inevitable to accept as our ideal the establishment of a completely precise and logical representation of knowledge, and to look upon any personal participation in our scientific account of the universe as a residual flaw which should be completely eliminated in due course. Now, this, I'm sympathetic toward this. I hope I made clear. I'm suggesting that science has been driven in a certain direction by its desire to eliminate the distortion of subjectivity from its account of the universe. But the consequences of accepting this ideal and implementing it in this particular way have not been fully recognized. To the extent that the use of this procedure prevents the introduction of error, it also prevents the introduction of any new theory. Really, if you think about it, if you reflect upon it carefully, given this simple way of doing science with all of its safeguards against the introduction of error, if someone were really to follow that, he not only would be unable to introduce error into science, he wouldn't be able to introduce any new knowledge either. And because of this, I don't think that those canons of procedure have ever really been followed by scientists or ever been given anything more than the programmatic status. The methodological ideal of the rigor is more honored in utterance than in practice. But the trouble is, rhetoric has its own life. You know, even when the preacher does not live the way he preaches, he has an impact on his congregation. Rhetoric has its own life and its own consequences. And the idea and ideal of a radical empiricism, coupled with a completely formalized procedure, has helped to mold the popular image of science. It's helped to foster the myth of the scientist as some kind of brilliant calculating machine, with no need for insight, no need for a sense of proportion, imagination, values, or any of the other faculties long associated with humanness. And I think it has been largely responsible for the popular faith in science as a machine that produces knowledge and techniques in accord with its own inner necessities. You see, science is a machine in which all of its own conclusions and technologies were originally resident And gradually, as the machine grinds on, more and more of these results fall out. And of course, as they fall out, we must submit to them, because they are being ground out by the machine. This misunderstanding of science has certainly put in eclipse in our time the notion of science as a human activity, which is aimed at understanding, at truth. It has finally, I think, lent very powerful support to the belief in our time that truth is nothing but the sum total of propositions, often indigestible propositions, emerging from the autonomous machine of science. Let me state that again. Some people have said science is the place where truth today is most respected. I'm suggesting that ain't the case. That while scientists, most scientists, are passionately committed to truth, science does not provide us with the best model because we misunderstand the nature of science. Science does not provide us with the best model when we want to know what is truth. That our image of science is not of men pursuing understanding, men willing to take everything into account, men saying nothing is alien to me. Or when we get to the social sciences, where the real problem lies now. The social scientist, he takes that name scientist upon himself, but his motto is not, nothing human is alien to me. His motto is, that which fits into my mechanical hopper, I will take account of. And that which does not lend itself to manipulation by my techniques, that which I cannot cram through my sausage grinder, is not amenable to scientific investigation. And therefore, finally, doesn't really exist. And man himself then becomes simply the sum total of propositions that emerge from the enormous sausage grinder. This now, this last thing I've been talking about in the social sciences, is what has come to be called the cult of scientism. And the cult of scientism, not science, may have contributed more than any other social phenomenon to the death of the spirit of man in our time. I am a social scientist. But of course, some of my colleagues say I'm a traitor. I think the most dangerous men in our society today are social scientists. Not all of them, of course. There are some who retain their rationality. There are some who still believe in humanity. There are some who believe in their own humanness. There are many who do not, and who are quite willing to sacrifice their humanness and your humanness on the altar of their God. Their God is scientism. The cult is rigorous and severe. Its claim is universal, and it looks with disdain upon any plea for exemption from its very stern discipline. They say science is a method. This method and this method alone yields truth. Everything must be subjected to its inexorable scrutiny and transformation, and that includes man. You see, man, too, is an object in the universe. So he must be studied with the same detachment, the same objectivity, the same unbending adherence to the canons of scientific method that we employ in the study of planets and rocks. If you don't do that, you're soft-headed. Any claim that you've got to study man by special methods, that man cannot be mastered through the established procedures of science, this is romantic, it's a mystical survival from a pre-scientific age. Right? These are quotations from scientific journals. I don't think it's not, excuse me, not scientific journals, journals of the social sciences. Men once believed that the objects of nature were like human beings, motivated by love or hate, purposive in their movements. If you go back in history, you'll find this is how we once explained the objects of nature. It was kind of an animism. Why does the tree grow? Because the tree has a soul like mine, and the tree, this tree's soul wants to rise up and overlook the world. You know, the stars, they have the planets, they have their inner motions, their inner intentions. We were conceiving of the whole universe in terms like ourselves. We were saying everything in the world is like man and is to be understood as if it were like man. Well, the overcoming of that error marked a long stride forward in the progress of scientific knowledge. But now the scientismists are saying the journey up from error will be complete when men draw the inevitable conclusion that human beings are not like human beings either, but are like the objects of nature. So we have gone from one extreme to the other. I actually, the very distinguished economist named Morris Copeland, an economist and psychologist, he's a dabbler in both, and plays around with philosophy on the side, in an article written some years ago, said, we must beware the anthropomorphic error in the study of man. I find that a phenomenal statement. We must beware of the anthropomorphic error in the study of man. That means we must beware in studying the man of assuming that man is like man. That leads to error. You see what he means? He says it very flatly. Everything in the universe is like everything else and must be studied in the same way with the methods of the physical scientists. The methods of the physical scientists misunderstood. And you can ask the question, why? Why should we give allegiance to this creed? Why should we go along with, what is he here? I hope not. Thought I had the page mark on there instead of having the page mark with that. Oh, here, I just read a quote from John B. Watson, who sort of comes before B.F. Skinner. Watson says, in short, the cry of the behaviorist, that's another name for scientismist, is, give me the baby in my world to bring it up in, and I'll make it crawl and walk. I'll make it climb and use its hands in constructing buildings of stone or wood. I'll make it a thief, a gunman, or a dope fiend. The possibility of shaping in any direction is almost endless. Why should we believe it? Why should we assume that man is just like the other manipulable objects in the universe? Why should we give allegiance to the creed of scientism? I don't know. Sometimes B.F. Skinner suggests it's because he'll create a brave new world for us if we let him. In fact, that's what he argues in Walden 2. If we will just forget our romantic, silly prejudices about free will and parental love and democracy, what are some of the things he attacks? Democracy, rationality, discussion, history. If we'll just remember that there is only one way to do anything, and that is by the controlled experiment. If we will admit that and then let those who are masters of controlled experiments, the behavioral psychologists, take over, they will create for us happy, happy, happy people. And as someone said, B.F. Skinner read Brave New World and missed the point. But now, you know, here is the irony. Skinner has tremendous prestige and status because he comes clothed in the banner of science. He would be, because someone said, who is the most scientific psychologist at work today? I'll bet you most psychologists would say B.F. Skinner. Even if they disapproved of him, they'd say he's the most scientific. Now, by what strange twist of fate has what Skinner is doing come to usurp the name scientific? If science was originally a passion for truth as experienced fact, how can a man like Skinner, who distorts and ignores what does not fit in his sausage grinder, who systematically perverts the evidence. Who systematically rejects, eliminates from consideration all the evidence that doesn't fit his model of science. How can he become the paradigm of the scientist? Skinner is a completely honest man. He is, as far as I can tell, a fine person, and there is no, he's got this dedication, all right, of the scientist. He's got it deep within him. But the error of which I'm talking, if indeed it is an error, is an intellectual and not a moral error. The question that puzzles me, the paradox, is why should these methods of Skinner be identified with scientific procedures in the social sciences? If science is the highest product of man's rational, creative activity, how is it that science has induced in man the belief that reason is a chimera and creativity an illusion? What's the strange masochism that compels us to believe that the violence which this cult does to our sense of personal dignity, because it does that, that this is sufficient to compensate for the irrationality of its foundation? You know, it seems to me sometimes weird in this box that if somebody tells us something that is uncomplimentary, somebody comes out with a new book, for example, that argues man is basically just a, we buy it. We got to buy it because he's insulting us. And to reject an insult, you know, would not be courageous. So you get a spate of new books. You know, somebody comes out with a weird new one. Fundamentally, man is driven just by his, all the examples are actual authors whom I haven't read, so. if somebody were to come out with a book arguing that religion, music is really the product of repression of man's desire to bust other people in the teeth. We'd have to say, by God, we might say, well, you can't fire anything since he's got profound insight. We're so worried that we're claiming some kind of false dignity for ourselves, some kind of unique place in the universe. We don't want to make any claims, we don't want to have any pretensions at all. It follows then that the more seriously somebody insults us, the more we're going to pay attention to it. If you tell me I'm beautiful, I must suspect your kingdom and my wishes, but if you tell me I'm ugly, do I have no choice but to believe you? Well, let me repeat once more. It is not science, in my view, which has stripped man of his humanity, because science is preeminently humane activity. It is rather the cult of scientism, the religion which asserts that science is a machine grinding out truth. Truth is everything ground out by the machine and nothing else. And the man's highest duty, ultimately he has no choice, is to surrender his life to the dictates of this marvelous machine. Cast all your cares upon it, for it careth for you. It provideth meat and flush toilets in due season. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, or for today. Take no thought at all. A thought is useless and illusory. Now in this kind of world, there is no room for spiritual life. It's implicitly excluded. Man has no spirit, no rational capacity, no power of perceiving, of comprehending. He is an object to be manipulated. He is completely conditioned in all his actions and words and thoughts. And the knowledge of man is the knowledge of his conditioning processes. That's all it is. And what is the challenge before us? To study these conditioning processes so that in the future we can condition man better. Or condition men to condition men to condition men better. Somebody beginning must have some freedom to, somewhere along the line. Well, I'm sure I've attended many people. I hope so. I've made this clear, whether I've gotten, allowed some of my prejudices to get me off the point. But what I'm not trying to attack even the social scientists. I am really suggesting that all of us, we, have all gotten somehow filtered down through our culture, and I suggested a line of transition or progression, transmission. We've all gotten the idea that we are conditioned objects, that we are just objects, we are complicated machines. And because we are machines, we can have no original thoughts. We can therefore have no rational capacity. We have no power of self-transcendence. And you see, from this follows all the ills to which I've been addressing myself this summer. Like the abandonment of rationality itself, the suggestion that all rationality is really rationalization, the notion that values are merely subjective preferences, the abandonment of moral discourse as a meaningless activity because it's about nothing, and it's about nothing because there are no values. Values are just subjective preferences. You can talk about your innards, and I talk about my innards, but that's what we're talking about, is our innards. And so when you say, I am in favor of a negative income tax, and I say I'm against it, we can examine the economic implications, but when that's all through, you say, well, I got my value judgments, and you got yours. And those value judgments are not about anything, it's just the way we feel inside. This is a part of it all. And of course, this leads in turn to the breakdown of democracy, because democracy is government by moral discourse. It leads then to the alternatives, which is government by brainwashing, by manipulation. We persuade, propagandize the public to go along sheepishly. Or on the other hand, government by violence, by direct action, where every group that feels strongly in its innards about something goes out and smashes until it gets what it wants. Eventually, I don't know what it's going to lead to, but as McLuhan says, there is nothing is inevitable if we see what is happening. Well, I'm going to quit. Who was the? If I can say, no, you don't have to talk about what I see, but talk about that. question, there is a kind of, but it deeply bothers me, a kind of a technological determinism that floats around in our society, that because we know how to do it, therefore we must do it. Everything that is possible must be done. And I think this goes back to this same sort of thing. The scientists here are not seen as, as men playing with the possibilities of things in their laboratory, but they're seen as agents locked into a process of the creation of applied knowledge. And so everything that comes out of the laboratory must be put to use, put to work. It's got to be. We have no choice. We have no choice. And so one of the things we do is we corrupt our environment at a fantastic rate by putting to work things that, and then somebody says, now get off your area and admire, and somebody says, but I think this is bad for the society as a whole. We get, what are the answers we get? Oh, who can speak for society as a whole? Oh, that's just your personal view because you don't like to drive a car. Well, you enjoy trains, and that's why you want to. And no one discusses the public interest. There is no such thing as the public interest. That's one of those mythologies that unenlightened men like Thomas Jefferson entertained. But he was a fool. He thought that men were human. He talked about the natural rights of man. And everybody knows men have no natural rights. This is a vestige of the old outmoded day when men thought that reason was capable of perceiving a natural law. That's stupid. Anybody squelched you all?
I think we're all still thinking, Paul.
May I make a comment?
Yeah.
You refer to this a human person, this isolation that our society is beginning to consider. If man is, say, a complex machine or like a computer taking a guy, again, bring it back down, determined. You said, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he's not rational. I think he is, because you said that he couldn't have any original thoughts, and I agree with this. But we are capable of mixing the data we get, and it's a call rationalization.
Yeah, you're using rational in the narrow sense, which is come to use today, but that's not rational in the Aristotelian sense, or in the historic sense of the word rational. Because when Aristotle speaks of man as a rational animal, he gives him an originated capacity. He's capable of producing that which has never existed before.
Can man do that? Can he? I don't know, I can't show
I can't that. Prove that he can, but no one can prove that he can't. And the weight of the evidence from the examination, not of the results of science, but of scientific activity itself, it seems to me the weight of the evidence is that he can.
We give prizes for it.
I can't think of any chance.
Where man has originally...
No, one thing that's completely original, that is totally disconnected from...
No, don't make it totally original, completely disconnected. But I think you have lots of original thoughts each day. Doesn't mean they're worth publishing, or that they're going to influence the course of the world. But you see the light hitting a leaf, and from that, you may fashion something new.
A self-defense machine for a leaf to get back into life.
So what? The question I'm worrying here is the nature of man, not which scholars are guilty of plagiarism, or how many of our original thoughts are. Lots of people have subjectively original thoughts that are not objectively original. This is a often happen. Somebody gets an idea and publishes it, or gets all set to publish, and finds out somebody has had the idea before. Just for one thing, in the history of science and invention, discoveries tend to occur simultaneously, because, you know, people are proceeding along a broad frontier at about the same pace, and the breakthroughs, certain specific breakthroughs, then tend to be simultaneous. But this idea can still be subjectively written.
Doesn't that just say, though, that when they're working in this field, that when they bring in the data of this field, that they're rearranging it at the same time? I don't think it's just rearranging. If you call that original, maybe, but the computer can do that.
I think the our fascination with analogies between the computer and the human brain is an evidence of this kind of thing. I can't prove you're wrong, but I insist you can't prove you're right. The presupposition that man is a machine, that everything that he does, thinks, and feels is conditioned, that everything which comes out from him is simply the resultant of everything that came into him, that he has no spiritual, imaginative, rational faculty, this cannot be proved. This is a presupposition. It is a presupposition which I was arguing people in our culture have been cajoled into accepting, or conditioned into accepting. And I think it is a most damaging presupposition. I'm suggesting that we make a Herculean effort and set ourselves free. That we say, maybe put it most simply, we do this. We say, here are two premises, both of which, let's say, are equally plausible, two fundamental images of man. Where do they lead? And we take the image of scientism, and we can see where it leads. One of the best descriptions of where it leads is in Roderick Seidenberg's book, Post-Historic Man. It leads to an ant-filled society. I think that's where it is. I think it can be shown that's where it leads. That's where it is leading. So we try the alternative view and see where it leads. Why can't we ask the question, where do we want to go?
You can, but you're taking the other extreme just as much as determinism would be the one extreme. Why can't you be in between? Or who's to say that through determinism we can't set up a world like Walden 2?
Well, Skinner wants to set up a world like Walden 2 and can get people to come. I'm willing.
There are two set up worlds. That's what psychology.
Fine, but Skinner is saying to us, we have no choice but eventually to go into communities like Walden 2. Eventually, it will come.
You also said that this computer type person has no spirit, and you can't do that either.